If PETA, Milo, and Otis, in honor of the Greasy Strangler and Birth of a Nation, what's the most offensive movie that you love anyway?
Oh, damn.
Katie had to put Charlie to bed, so I guess I'm first.
Yeah.
I'm Dave with the 7, and I'm going to go with Live and Let Die, which I thought was a great Roger Moore romp when I was a child, and have revisited to realize that most James Bond is racist.
I'm going to go with That's My Boy, the 2012 Adam Sandler movie that starts with statutory rape jokes and ends with incest jokes.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm also going to go with the James Bond movie, You Only Live Twice, which is so flagrantly racist to the Japanese that it does make it difficult to enjoy, but it's also such a lunkheaded and silly James Bond adventure, comes back from the dead as a Japanese man, as long as taken with an appropriate grain of salt. It's hard not to enjoy on some level.
Japanese Sean Connery.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is episode 139 for Tuesday, October 4th, and on this day, according to Dave with a 7, in 1957, with a 7, the Russians launched Sputnik 1, the first artificial Earth satellite into orbit, and the perfect way to open the Iron Giant, if I may be so bold.
Well, also just great for humans into space. I went to space camp as a child, so some of these things are burned into my mind.
Sputnik is burned into your mind based on space camp? Did you go to Russian
Sputnik,
space camp?
Yuri Gagarin? No, they're just first, man. First is important in science. I mean, see, the important thing is we have to acknowledge
America.
That the Russians did certain things first so we could just rub the moon in everyone's face.
Rub the moon in their face. See, Operation Avalanche.
I think it's the third Transformers movie.
Dark of the rub the moon in your face. Speaking of Dark of the Moon, a favorite of David Ehrlich. David, do we have any reviews this week?
We have one.
Oh, boy. Lacking.
It's quite short, so perhaps we can get some more to read in the section of next week's episode. From Mike D. 823, gives us 3 stars. The subject of the review is Atlanta. My review. Why no Atlanta talk? End of review. Bye.
Damn.
So
a mic drop.
I guess we will be watching Atlanta.
Have you watched?
Are you guys
Atlanta
not watching Atlanta? I've been up to date
great.
With Atlanta. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I mean, it's certainly
not because
the replacement
we don't like it.
For girls. If you are into girls, you will like Atlanta. Different areas of the map, but still.
Oh, see, I've been pitching like a Master of None for high people.
Hmm. I can see that, although they get high in Master of None. I guess they're just eating.
Well, I'm just
Brooklyn
saying that
food.
This one is more at the pace of Master of None for high people. I think that describes Atlanta's pace pretty
it's
well.
It's hazy.
It is.
Although it also is bonkers. Like last episode, they had the black Justin Bieber, and that was phenomenal. Hilarious. David,
yeah,
you're not
crazy.
Watching the show.
I don't watch much TV, but I will, because I do pretty much anything that our reviewers tell us. Watch Atlanta.
And keep that in mind when you leave reviews after this week's episode. You're going to rush to iTunes. You're going to plug in Fighting in the War Room because you already subscribe. You're going to give yourself a pat on the back for doing so. And then you're going to leave a review because it's finally time to do that or convince someone else to do that. Come on, get on it. Support the show. Helps us climb the charts and beat all these other podcasts who... Come on, they're just gaming the system at this point. Every television show has a podcast now, 8 podcasts, and they're all gaming the system, just like Storm of Spoilers. No, I'm just kidding.
Yep.
We need to find a new podcast to rib that is not billions related.
I'm not looking at it, but I assume there are 8 Westworld podcasts with different puns. Like
already?
The Westworld Westcast. I don't know. Yeah, probably. It's time.
Or like your host pod.
Okay, we're killing this segment right away. So go on iTunes, leave a review, and on with the show. So for this week's tidbit, we're going to talk about The Girl on the Train. Now, Dave, you have not seen this movie. Do you know anything about The Girl on the Train?
So Jake Gyllenhaal is sent back in time into somebody else's body to stop a train from exploding.
That was a girl on a train.
Oh, this is the girl. Oh, so this is the Emily Blunt movie.
Yes. You got it. Yes. This movie is based on a very popular book. I don't know. My significant other, Michelle, has read that, and she kind of rolled her eyes at it, actually. After The Gone Girl, I think her book club really wanted to read The Girl on the Train because it was becoming a phenomenon. So they read it, and they all rolled their eyes. I did not inquire why, because I wanted to go in The Girl on the Train fresh. And I knew that it was getting compared to Gone Girl. I knew it was going to be a little twisty, maybe a little pulpy, maybe a little trashy. The same way if everyone out there listened to our Gone Girl review a while back. God, when was that? 2 years ago? Oh, Jesus, we're getting old. David, you declared Gone Girl trash, but that was a positive.
Yeah,
that was praise.
I called it a trash masterpiece.
Yes. Okay. There you go. So
and I was reading the comment section on Badass Digest, or the formerly known as Badass Digest, now Birth Movies Death, where I wrote that review, and someone chided me for not using the neologism trashterpiece. So I can't remember if I actually did, but
retroactive.
I remember making an effort to use it in my review of The Girl on the Train, which largely revolved around Gone Girl and how much a superior film Gone Girl is to this cheap knockoff.
Well, so, yeah, you can understand why people are comparing this to Gone Girl. It's a mystery thriller starring Emily Blunt, Rebecca Ferguson, Justin Theroux, Luke Evans, Edgar Ramirez, Haley Bennett, this girl who looks exactly like Jennifer Lawrence, who was in Magnificent Seven, and she's everywhere now. I guess she's going to be in Terrence Malick's new movie.
Was she the one that was in the first person?
Yes, she was. She was also in Kaboom.
Oh, yeah.
The Rocky film, and she was fantastic in that. So she's been around for a while.
She's actually good in all these
music
movies.
And Lyrics, in which she plays Cora with a pop star. She doesn't sing Pop Goes My Heart, but Hugh Grant sings Pop Goes My Heart. But she sings the song that Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore write for her. And she is wonderful in that role as well, and was in The Magnificent Seven. She's everywhere.
She's good in that movie, too. And all these people have been wrangled by Tate Taylor, the auteur behind The Help and Get On Up, the James Brown biopic. And so he's kind of stepping out of his mode a bit here, which these cheery, sunny, vibrant, energetic films, and he's going into deep, dark, brooding territory, even though I would compare all three of them. They're all kind of a 90s mode. I feel like The Girl on the Train is a very 90s thriller down to like the swishy, what do you call the Wong Kar Wai effect where the frame
printing.
Yes, it's just that like every time there's a flashback, the whole thing is getting fuzzy and kooky.
Can I just say how much I hate that look?
I love
Wong Kar Wai as much as anybody. He was able to make that technique work for him to a certain degree. I hated it in the Lord of the Rings films, which are otherwise flawless, and I hate it here because nobody else uses it to those sort of artistic ends. It all just looks like everything about this movie looks cheap. Everything
really does.
It feels second rate, like it was shot for network television. Television in and of itself, not an insult anymore, but network television, the supreme insult.
But it has a very network television plot, too. You know, a Shondaland version of The Girl on the Train would have been better than The Girl on the Train.
It would have been crazier.
Yeah, much crazier. The setup of this is that Emily Blunt's character Rachel is an alcoholic who is divorced from her husband Tom, who's played by Justin Theroux.
And she controls a giant monster.
What?
And she controls a giant monster? God damn it. I'll get it one of these times. Keep going.
So she caught him cheating. They're broken up. She rides the train all the time because she's an alcoholic and she can't stop staring at their old house where he's with his new wife. Meanwhile, she's also catching Haley Bennett's character who smooches her husband, Luke Evans, on their porch. She spends a lot of time looking at porches from the train. And then she gets caught up in a murder mystery. So David, long setup, but is this a trashster piece?
No. This is, for worse, what Gone Girl would have looked like had it been directed by the guy who made The Help. It is exactly what it says on the tin. I think the book at least had this sort of finely serrated prose to it. Paula Hawkins, who wrote it, knows what she's doing with a sentence. There's an interior life that she gives to the protagonist that makes the character feel richer, and has the idea of this sort of this woman whose personality has been shaped by, and sense of self and self-worth has been shaped by, the men around her. It really taps into that in a way that the movie gives lip service to briefly, but doesn't explore at all. And so what you end up getting is a barely competent, really hokey, surface-level Gone Girl that has none of the things that make Gone Girl interesting. None of the artistry, none of the subversion, none of, like...
None of the straight-up character, trash. Just, like, even the simplest aspects of Gone Girl are not achieved in this movie. This movie just plods along. It's so boring and miserable.
It's so boring. Oh, my God. And all you get, though, out of this... Emily Bennett is good, I think, but is Emily Blunt, who does about as well as one could with this material. I think she plays... She really leans into the idea of this woman being a drunk disaster, and she imbues her with life, and the movie just gives her less and less sensible, intelligent places for her to go, but she does what she can with what she's got. It's just so serviceable. I mean, this is a movie that is written by, or adapted by, the screenplay by the woman who wrote Men, Women, and Children, which, if that doesn't stop you in your tracks, pun of course intended, it should. It's an immensely boring movie, and it's one of those psychological thrillers that uses serious and very real psychological phenomena, things like repression and denial, as really cheap fodder for, like, dime store psychological nonsense that manifests itself on screen like one of those movies. This is one of those movies where there's a traumatic incident and somebody can only remember enough of it to keep you strung along for a while, and then, like, as their memory unfolds...
Through magic, as far as
they,
I know.
Right, through magic. Right, they gain it through frames here or there, and then eventually, by the end, they finally remember who the real killer was and what they saw, with no psychological basis.
Or really, by the end, they're having visions of moments they have not experienced themselves.
Yes. The way that they finally unveil the truth of what happened to Haley Bennett's character is, like, so lazy. It's such a giant fuck you to anyone who cares about this stuff, because it's unmotivated by a character. The information sort of simply appears. Ugh.
Well, I think what's interesting is I walked out of the movie, I was with Michelle, I was talking to her about, you know, this film has three female characters who are all revolving around motherhood on some level. Emily Blunt's character wanted to be a mother and couldn't get pregnant. The woman that her husband left her for did have a baby, and she's obsessed with her, overbearing to a breaking point. And then you have the Haley Bennett character, who you come to learn. I mean, this is minor spoilers, but not a big deal. Her relationship with children is interesting, because it's, and if you think I've spoiled it just through teasing, I have not. It's complicated, but she has a relationship to children as well, and so there's something there. They're picking at this, but they never scratch it. You know, they never cut it open and let it really bleed all over the page. I don't really understand what this movie's aiming to be about. And maybe that's what separates it from Gone Girl in the end.
Yeah, it doesn't work with just the plot alone, which is really what they have distilled the story into. Because on its surface,
it's not really a mystery. Solving the mystery at all.
It's just a very silly whodunit that's totally implausible and not very interesting. The whole appeal of the novel, I think, at least, and the novel was a phenomenal, blockbuster success that... there was a while there where you couldn't go on public transportation without seeing a girl on a train reading The Girl on the Train. But there was there is that depth of the characters. They do have the claws out in the book and do more than just scratch the surface of these topics. They really do sort of explore the element of perspective that floats between these three women. It's all ultimately Rachel's story, Emily Blunt's character's story, but the novel makes an effort to really filter what we're hearing through the perspective of the woman who is serving as the narrator at the time, whereas the movie does a very half-hearted job of saying, like, it has title cards in the beginning for each of the three women, and then it sort of abandons that concept altogether.
Right.
It's just the movie, very Yeah.
The movie ends up being so fraught because, I mean, the phlegm budget on this movie is astronomical. She's just, Emily Blunt is always sniffling. You'd think it was a Republican at a election debate. There's so much sniffling. The movie ends up being so fraught that it becomes hilarious at times, too. There's a scene where Emily Blunt has a kid in her hands and she puts on a grass and runs away. Everyone in my theater just cracked up. I think we were just waiting for something outlandish to happen in this movie. But no, it's one note panged over and over and over again. It's just depressing. Not fun.
So,
but,
okay.
But,
Emily
but,
Blunt's... Oh, okay.
I have to say this, and David, I want to know if you agree with me. I thought the end was pretty satisfying.
Yeah, the movie is absolutely at its best in the last 10
minutes. 10 minutes! So. 10 minutes of a lot of fun.
When it finally, veers its way into territory that's a little bit pulpier, a little bit juicier, a little bit more fun, where all of the things that's shied away from tapping into it unleashes, and it lets the blood flow, and it has fun with it, but it's a very cheap kind of fun that doesn't really last, and then it delivers it to you, and you're out. But this is it patches at the nail on the head at the start of the segment. That, like, really the death knell for a movie like this that's just trying to be, I think it was sold as having higher aspirations, but once you sit down and the movie starts, it's clear that this is really just meant to be a bit of popcorn fun in the early autumn. It cannot afford to be boring, and it is deeply boring. You will resent the fact that you're there about 30 minutes in. You won't care about who killed who or why. And you really are just left with the pleasure of watching some attractive people and Emily Blunt hold it down as a convincing drunk.
She's a good actress. She is a really good actress.
Yeah.
It's so disappointing. But it revved my engines a bit when she drinks martinis and gets wasted at the Oyster Bar in Grand Central Station, which is where I proposed to my fiance. So, that really, that part is the best part of the movie. Wait, Dave, I cut you off for a second. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, having you both seen it, how unscathed does Emily Blunt come out? Because it sounds like you guys liked her performance, but it's like it's another movie, another Emily Blunt movie that has to hang on that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, as I said, my mind wandered during this movie because I had nothing better to do to our conversation about, oh my God, I can't even remember the Snow White.
Salmon fishing in the Yemen? Maybe?
No, not salmon. Actually, I like salmon fishing in the Yemen. No, I'm thinking of the White Witch Queen movie that was the spinoff of Snow White.
Oh,
yeah. Huntsman.
Gentleman.
And that's just a total disaster. But she's still good. She's not a star, but she can only give her best in every trite material she's offered. So, I mean, I'm still an Emily Blunt fan, even after this. And Rebecca Ferguson, too. She doesn't get enough to do, but this is not the Mission Impossible Rogue Nation follow-up I was waiting for. Not enough squeezing men with her thighs.
Yeah, that's Xenia on a top.
That's what we're looking for. Girl on the Train comes out this week. See it.
Maybe.
Nah.
Maybe not.
Yo, Sway, man, I can't even describe it, man. The situation was crazy, bruh. If I was a gorilla, I would say it was bananas, B. For real, the man just took over the whole situation, God. Listen, man, it is what it is. Can't understand a man if you ain't lived what he lived. Coaches in the crib ain't got no food up.
For our mini segment tonight, we're going to be talking about Luke Cage. Which it seems like, to a certain extent, we're going to be the only people talking about Luke Cage, because unlike Marvel's previous Netflix shows, this one has landed with a real thud, so far as I can tell. It seems to be very timely. This is a show that is about a invulnerable, bulletproof black man in a hoodie as a superhero. It's a compelling premise, given our fraught times. And I think people were intrigued by that, but I'm gonna hand off the segment in a moment to the people who've actually watched the show, because Jessica Jones remains the only Marvel show that I've seen on Netflix. The reports that I've read from movie and TV people and civilians alike is that it is boring and poorly paced and does not mine any of the potential offered by its characters or scenario. Patches and Dave, is that the case?
But that's the dirty secret of every Marvel TV show. That's how I pass the baton to Dave here, because Dave, you would have to make a case for me about any show being that really pops. I think Luke Cage is just as good as Jessica Jones. It's definitely better than Daredevil, but that's not saying much.
No, and I think what Daredevil is better at than the other Netflix shows is just its action, but that might have just been because it was the first guy who punches really hard to come out of the gate, and that's what we're going to be getting for the rest of our series, except for Jessica Jones. It was a girl who punched really hard. But, Luke Cage falls into all the traps that Marvel Netflix series has. It slams on the brakes to tell an origin story. It has to take a hero out of the game so Rosario Dawson's Claire could fix him or her up, and it has to sort of lead to a big villain showdown. This one, I think, because it doesn't know how to properly pace its story for its big bad, really is the Marvel series with the most forgettable villain on Netflix, with Diamondback, who comes in late in the game after Cottonmouth Stokes sort of takes a backseat in the plot. After being like pumped up as the main villain. And at least that one, I was watching like a Marvel series that was A, very black, and B, very aware that if it was going to be black, it could pull from stuff like blaxploitation and very specific periods of rap and R&B, and not necessarily do something that came out as a specific type of black. It doesn't have to be blackish and played all types of black. It picked a couple of recognizable New York types of black, if not necessarily Harlem types of black. And, service this story about this guy who punches a lot. The underlying social themes are definitely there in the way the politicians talk and the way people talk about their community and how their community deals with things like family and money. But then the times that it only really sings is maybe once towards the end of the series, when Method Man comes in with a song in show, and everybody is rallying behind Luke Cage. They come up with the symbol of wearing hoodies with bullet holes in them, and so the neighborhood's wearing hoodies with bullet holes in them. Otherwise, they give a lot of lip service to being a show about the Harlem community. But then also, it's a fictional world that doesn't even acknowledge that the Hulk and Abomination tore it up, which I thought they would at least nod to a little bit. So it's got its starts and stops. I will say that all the performances in it are excellent. I think that Mike Coulter's Luke Cage is just instantly there. But whether or not they have an interesting story, your mileage is going to vary. It definitely takes its time.
Yeah,
what do you think, Patches?
I mean, I totally agree with you on everything, and I wish that it felt more embedded in a community, that the black identity of the show was less about dropping references to relevant issues or to pop culture and more ingrained. I think of The Get Down, which felt like it was really part of that community. It was clicking at every moment, whether it be character, whether it be a set piece. It was all, filtered through this neighborhood, and I don't know. It feels very sterile in Luke Cage, which is unfortunate because Mike Coulter feels really vibrant and he can't sustain it.
Is The Get Down ever coming back?
There's a second half of it coming in 2017 at some point, but yeah.
That seems like an abnormally long gap for half a season.
Well, what I've been told is that, I forget who told me this, and hopefully it wasn't off the record. No, it was not. It was not. That they wanted to get some episodes out of the gate for The Get Down, because it was taking so long and it was so big. So they just, did the unprecedented thing. Do 6 episodes here and they'll do 6 episodes later. Meanwhile, Marvel shows come freaking, how many episodes? 1,000 in this first season of Luke Cage?
13 on Luke Cage.
Jesus, it's just so long. If this were an 8-episode series, it would fly and there'd be a great mystery and Luke Cage would discover himself and his powers. And first off, I'm tired of these reluctant heroes. We saw Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. He is established. He discovered himself. He was on a path, and that path seems to have been abandoned. And it almost feels like Luke Cage was supposed to be a prequel that suddenly became a sequel because they got Claire.
Could be a spoiler, so don't answer if it is. But are characters that I would recognize from only watching Jessica Jones in this show?
No.
Nope. That's the weirdest thing. There's no crossover there, but there's crossover to Daredevil, which is...
A voice cameo from Jessica Jones. There's a Trish Talk voiceover, but if you're not, like, listening, you're not going to be like, oh, that's right. Trish Talk.
And are we getting a second season of Jessica Jones in 2017?
I don't think we will.
No?
No, we're going to get Iron Fist, and then we're going to get the Defenders. And I just can't imagine...
a third one.
I can't imagine that the Defenders will have the scope necessary. I kept thinking throughout Luke Cage, why is there not a Marvel show that's on par with Game of Thrones and Westworld, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but just something bigger and something meatier and something with higher stakes. Like, that's the problem with Luke Cage. There's no mystery. The enemies aren't coming after him, or there's no real conflict firing up the screen. There's just nothing happens in Luke Cage, and it entirely rests on Mike Coulter's shoulders, and luckily, he can shoulder a lot of weight. He's a big dude. But the show is just... I watched 3 episodes and had a good time. By episode 5, I'm like, I don't need to do this anymore. And that, yet I did, but...
Yeah, and that wasn't even before the big turn, which happens in episode 7, and then you still have half the series to go.
Yeah, Diamondback is actually... That actor is very good. I don't have his name off the top of my head, but he's very good. And the woman who plays Misty, Simone Missick, she's very good. Everyone is so good. Alfre Woodard doing, you know, crime boss lady stuff. It's
and
all
hopefully,
very
you know, a lot
warm,
of them
but...
will get to return for something.
For season 2, which we'll also kind of like, but not really. Oh, well.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Defenders, because I've been hearing things that I can't straight up put on a podcast, but it might be slightly bigger than we all expected it to be.
So you're saying I'll probably watch it, get excited by the first 3 episodes, and kind of be meh about it by the middle.
Yeah, but at that point, your numbers have already been logged as the first day binger, so bad.
He says we all expect it as though we all have any idea what the hell a Defender is.
It's a team!
can't wait for it to be shoved down my throat.
Luke Cage, check it out. Or wait and then listen to our Star Wars spoilers about it.
See it
tomorrow.
Oh, really? Luke Cage is the topic?
You bet.
Sweet Christmas.
Sweet Christmas. Sunday on HBO, Westworld, based on the Michael Crichton novel, loosely based on the Michael Crichton novel.
It's not a novel.
I'm sorry, it's a movie.
Yeah, it became a novel
right off
after.
The top of my head, I just busted out.
I'm here for you.
The Yul Brynner is a bad robot cowboy in a theme park for rich people movie is now being adapted into an HBO series that has had a few bumps in the road getting to production. When did we first know this was actually going to happen?
I think 2013 might be the answer to that question. I don't have it in front of me, but I will have
to look
that up. It got
to the point where eventually it was delayed enough that not only has it been around, I think, since the beginning of the D8, does HBO have a non-Game of Thrones drama problem? It might actually be the original source of that by how many times it's like tripped coming to production.
Well, I think they came up with the idea because J.J. Abrams, who was a producer on the show, was sitting around his office being like, man, I love my company, Bad Robot. And then another guy was like, yeah, Bad Robot, like Westworld. And he's like,
and then they're like, let's hire Jonathan Nolan. He's not doing any superhero movies anymore.
That's how it came about.
Yeah, and then Anthony Hopkins just like wandered it off the Thor set and had no idea.
You're in!
It's amazing for all the bad movies that Anthony Hopkins has done, how much authority he brings to a project instantly. Like, there's a pedigree that is imbued with the show the moment he shows up on screen. We're like, oh, okay, this is legit.
He's a Shakespearean actor. This is Lion in the Winter, Anthony Hopkins, reading mumbo jumbo like it's Shakespeare. And actually, some of it is Shakespeare.
Yeah, no, he's the one who points out the Shakespeare, and you're like, of course Anthony Hopkins would know that. But anyway, the premise, as we, Evan Rachel Wood plays a woman. I mean, are we assuming they've at least seen the pilot if we're talking about
it? Yes, of course, of course.
All right, so plays the original host in this theme park for rich people, supposedly. It is the Wild West themed. We realize that her and Cyclops from the X-Men movies are both these mechanical hosts who are running through a sort of romantic plot where he's coming back to see her after some time on the train, and then Ed Harris as the new Man in Black shows up. And in a twist from the movie, Ed Harris is supposedly the not host character in this because he cannot be hurt by the host. The bullets just bounce off him. So he gets all rapey, and we cut around as the people who are programming these hosts for the park track a bug in the newest update, which was supposed to do something by giving the host some sort of subconscious by
reveries
allowing them to
is what they call them. Their they ability call them the reverie programs. To access their old programming. So one guy in the premiere used to be, I don't know why you would program someone to be a cult leader in the Wild West, but that's what he was. And then he became the sheriff, but he's remembering
Because he was
his
a cult leader that turned cannibalistic out in the, you know, so it's like they
the movie has borrowed, I mean, the series rather, has borrowed a lot from the modern era of open world video games.
Oh, for sure. I mean, so Jonah Nolan himself cites BioShock and Red Dead Redemption would be the big one, I think, for him. That those are
so
the two
I
main
think
inspirations.
It's like the river seems to be the border, at least from the pilot, that like there's that one black couple that has the kid, and they're like, we can't go past the river. That's too adult for him. So it's like the further you get away from the town, the crazier things supposedly get. It's hinted at this pilot. But then, so we also spend some time with the people behind the scenes as they try to trace this bug that is allowing people to realize their old memories. And we're told constantly that their number one safeguard is they can't hurt any living thing. And the pilot comes to a close as Evan Rachel Wood's character nonchalantly swats a fly on her neck. And presumably it's living and she kills it. So there's a ghost in the machine.
Now, Patches and I have seen the first four episodes of the show, so through the month of October. And
no spoilers.
I will see, the issue, we were talking off podcast about spoiling, when it occurred to me that my biggest criticism of the show thus far is that we have not learned very much through four episodes that you did not learn in the initial one. That is very, you know, and that is not necessarily a bad thing.
It's so welcome. This is my new Mad Men. This is like, just stand around and talk about nothing.
So my big issue with Westworld is whether or not it's a smart, dumb show or a dumb, smart show. And Mad Men was a smart, smart show.
Sure.
I would much prefer for this to be a smart, dumb show than a dumb, smart show, because I wanted to know what it is at least. But I do think that there is a certain familiarity with a lot of the themes and tropes that it explores and how it's exploring them, that I think it's so dazzled by its own ideas that it's never going to break out of that shell.
This is my big question to both of you, which is, we've kind of been in this territory before. I guess most recently is probably Ex Machina, like right on the nose. We've explored some of this AI and freeing oneself. And do you think that Westworld is on a road to explore new territory, to become either smart dumb or smart smart, and like really go somewhere we've never gone before, or consider something new about AI?
I don't think this is ever going to be a smart smart show. I don't think that that's in its DNA or its robot coding.
You don't think a shootout to a old-timey piano version of Paint It Black points to smart smart in the future?
No, and spoiler alert for the second episode, the player piano starts playing Radiohead, so I should be in the tank for this. It's a fun show. I enjoyed the third and fourth episodes have a lot less going on than the first two, but they really just repeat similar revelations, but with greater gravity. It's like one character has a reverie in one episode and then another character has one in the fourth episode. And you're like, they can still have memories. They still feel things, you know? I have never been particularly, as we've talked about on this podcast before, I've never been super enamored by the idea of machines learning to think and the empathy we have for them because, like, playing Bioshock, for example, for me, it never feels to me like we're dealing with real people. I know that is a video game character. I know this is a code. I'm not saving the little girls so I don't get better power-ups. Kill them. I have no emotional attachment. It's
yes, but this is the evolution of that behavior. Right. That's nurturing it to a new point.
And so what Ex Machina brings to the equation is the idea of sex and how, like, that could be the thing that and romantic interest, and that could help transcend our logical brains telling us that this is a thing made out of metal and so on. And that's why I'm unusually preoccupied while watching Westworld with the idea of, like, what are these robots made out of? What do they feel like? How believable is the experience? You see in the first episode, the first or the second robot that Anthony Hopkins' character ever designed is like a Wild Bill type character, and he makes, like, robot noises when he moves. It's super rudimentary. And, you know, they're essentially still made out of the same stuff, and you're like, what, you know, how different do they feel?
Although it's pretty detailed, and there's one scene in the premiere where it's kind of like stringing sinew of this resin-type material. I guess it's like 3D printing, but it seems very, very detail-oriented.
It seems like a silly point, but this is a show that is not shying away from vices. It's not shying away from the idea that men, in particular, and so far the overwhelming majority of the clients who come to Westworld have been men, are going to be like Donald Trump's kids on safari in Africa when they come to this place. Like, they are going to be raping and murdering, and they're not going to be shy about it, and that's what they're going to be doing, and that's human nature, and so on. So I do think, to that end, it is important for them to stress how realistic these things are. What do they feel like? I need to know more about the bullets. This sound like little things, but, like, if you're going to get me to the point where maybe by the end of the season I believe that a human character could care for Evan Rachel Wood's character, for example, like, the illusion needs to be complete.
I think they're a little more complicated than, like, a fleshlight with legs here, so.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's a...
well,
prove it.
Cinematically. There's a moment in Ex Machina, which is not a movie that I love, but it does one thing very effectively, which is when he is... she's getting dressed, she's getting dressed, and she puts on the sweater for the first time, and all of a sudden, in the span of a single shot, you see her go from a robot to looking like a human woman, and you appreciate why he could possibly have real feelings for Alicia Vikander. And I think that, like, you need that moment here to really galvanize my belief in this. But it is playing with a lot of really interesting ideas. So far, not in a way that I find inherently more interesting. It's got some Lost elements going on. Ed Harris's character, who we don't technically know.
He could still be a robot.
He's a human. He could totally be a robot.
Well,
I
okay.
Really need to know about the bullets.
We don't know. We don't know that anybody's real at this point, except probably Anthony Hopkins because of his angst. But, like,
well,
this is like, I think less of like a Lost, Mad Men thing. It's Battlestar Galactica again. But now we've just taken a different movie from that time period
Anthony
and applied our thing.
Anthony Hopkins high on my list of people who I suspect are robots.
Well, what's interesting, Anthony Hopkins has an interesting line in the pilot about how, you know, the robots have gotten to such a close point to human behavior and human life that there's really nothing left for him to do. And eventually they'll bring Lazarus out of the pit. They'll raise the dead, which really got me going, like, everyone who's old in the show is probably a robot who's been transcendence Johnny Depp style imported into people, into robots. That's
what's
my new
interesting thing. Is that we don't know. We get the sense that the show is taking place at some point in the future because we see, like, the fancy trains that they ride, and they have this great Minority Report like technology underground. But we don't know exactly when the show is taking place.
I can't wait to see the outside
where
world.
It's taking place.
Yeah, or where, and we don't know if there are other theme parks, and we don't. One thing that I thought was really interesting that I believe is also mentioned in the pilot is the idea of the characters being too realistic for them to continue sustaining the illusion for guests that come to the park. It is a version of the myth of total cinema, of the idea of making, and we're about to see this with 120 frames per second with the new Ang Lee film, where things could potentially be so realistic that they no longer feel at all realistic, because there needs to be this sort of, like, middle ground of things being just plausible enough to fool the mind so that you can entertain the various storylines you fall into. And that is something that's fun that's happening in the story as well. When the characters begin thinking that maybe everyone else around them is human, they can't kill them wantonly anymore. They're not going to want to rape everyone all the time. It's going to be the gamesmanship of it all. What they're paying $40,000 a day for will be taken away. So it's a fine needle that the creators and the programmers behind Westworld have to thread. The park, not the show.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just interested to see, like, on a show like this that is going to be serialized and is going to continue until it runs out of steam, and from your guys' description of it kind of is taking its time going wherever it's going, like, AI is just, like, the first movement that this story can provide of weird sci-fi tropes. Like, their cold storage is a lobby in the pilot, and they talk about, like, rotating home, which could be, like, we're on Mars, or it could be, like, we're all hosts as well, just, like, this mid-level of host. There's a lot of really vague, interesting table settings that could lead to different debate if they want to go beyond AI.
My hope is robot revolt that ends with the outside world becoming like the Wild Wild West, so that it's still Westworld, but in the real world. Think about it. Dave, I have a question for you. We were talking about the pace of this show. Take me back to the beginning of Game of Thrones. I don't remember the first season very well, but I don't remember there being, like, big dramatic leaps in the way we think about Game of Thrones today. We're like, okay, there's always going to be four or five plot lines in a single episode. Who's going to die? What crazy twist is there going to be? Obviously, that's building on, you know, six seasons of the show. And I feel like reading reactions to Westworld, people already want to get there with this show. They just want to be really invested in the characters or see what the crazy twists are going to be. Like, get on with it, get to that point. But Game of Thrones was not like that in the season one, right?
I mean, no, it's basically season one's, it's a couple of things. It's setting up, like, the houses and who's related to who, and then it's a little bit of history, so you know why who's related to who is important and why Ed's traveling to King's Landing. But then it's just, like, a mystery about who Joffrey's, you know, true parents are, and as soon as that hits the fan, the series is out. So there's a Daenerys plotline that's running on the sideline, but the first season of Game of Thrones is very simple, to the point where it's basically a chapter-for-chapter adaptation of the book.
And then someday it lost David. The show just... David, were you into season one of Game of Thrones?
Yeah, I mean, I watched it from the start, but I didn't... I had to watch the first two or three seasons again, so, like, in short order when they were all available, to, like, really get into it. But... Yeah, I am concerned that Westworld will fall into a lost, like, Battlestar Galactica-esque, whatever you want to call it, trap of just, they're planting mysteries right now that they're going to water for years and years, or that, you know, my sense is that that's the plan. I hope that they explore the opportunities that the premise provides them more thoroughly rather than just wait for these twists to be revealed. I will say, to their credit, at least in the four episodes we saw, the questions that we're raising now are questions that we are bringing to the table from our own viewing experience, from other shows. It's how we've been conditioned to watch these things. But they have not really teased the outside world. They have not rubbed it in our faces, the idea that Ed Harris's character or anyone else could be a robot in disguise.
I don't think they've teased like a Lost-like mystery where the whole show will eventually be solved. There's nothing even like that. Everything they're setting up in this first episode feels like something that could pay off and eventually raise the stakes of a season two or three.
Yeah, I mean, but then they're at the center of it, literally in every which way, is a literal maze that Ed Harris's character is trying to solve. And that has Lost-like potential.
It's a video game.
All over it. We will see. So far they've been good about it. There is one character in the first 20 minutes of the pilot who we think is a human and turns out to be a host. And HBO and all of their screeners explicitly ask people not to.
So weird.
And that was it. I mean, that is it for, I feel like I know why. And it's because I was watching the pilot again with my fiance and she immediately assumed, she like was sort of talking back to the TV, and she like immediately assumed that character was a human, like you were supposed
to. And probably the hero.
And then, Right. And then like a few minutes or a few minutes before it's revealed that they're a host, she was like, wait a second, and started putting it together. And I think in doing so herself better understood on like a pliable level how this world works,
right,
and how to think about it going
Thanks
forward.
Thanks for deflating that moment for me, HBO.
Well, they didn't want us to take that work away from the audience so that they weren't thinking actively in the same way.
I was talking to Katie about Westworld earlier today, and since she couldn't be here, I should relay the fact that she actually really liked the show, but that she was saying that they need to make her care about certain characters for her to enjoy it as much as, say, Game of Thrones or something. And to you guys, are there characters in this show that you're rooting for, that you're invested in, or is this all going to be mystery? Is it all going to be answers and sci-fi turns and themes and ideas?
Well, I think that like four episodes in, the one character they really want you to care about emotionally is not human, which is an interesting choice, which is Evan Rachel Wood's character. And I don't. And there are some of the human characters, supposedly human characters. One is played by Sidse Babett Knudsen from The Duke of Burgundy. And I like her a lot as an actress, and I'm sort of inherently predisposed to caring about what is going on with her, but her character's relationship with Jeffrey Wright's character, it's the closest they come to having human points of interest, but they're not there yet. So my short answer to Katie's question would be no, or Katie's point, four episodes in, I don't really care about anyone.
Dave, what about you?
After the pilot, I cared about Evan Rachel Wood's character. I mean, it might get harder if they go all dollhouse with her and start cycling through personalities where it's harder to like her. Because, like, much the problem with having a robot character that have interchangeable personalities is that that might feel like retcon in certain television series and not sort of, like, carry through. So it's going to be interesting, but I'm at least primed to care for that character. They're one episode in, I'm theirs to lose for their main character at least. And then I want to see Anthony Hopkins' character just like talk about stuff. So in that sense, I guess I care about that character, but I'd be like in for his monologue show, like his, you know, Bob Ross of building robots out of milk. I'd watch that.
I'm really struck by Evan Rachel Wood's performance in the show so far. Maybe I'm not invested in her as a character yet because I'm waiting for her to break free. And, you know, Dave, as you said, maybe they could reboot her and trap her in other personalities. I think she's past that point. She's become, even in the first episode, it seems like she is sentient on some level where either the reveries will inform her or something beyond that will drive her and break the programming. But her performance is so interesting because she's constantly flipping back and forth. And I wonder if it's somehow CG enabled. I think there are a few scenes where the robots like turn off. And it's a special effect.
Yeah, they just like
freezing them in place. But she has a moment at the end of that premiere where she is talking in her southern accent or being really terrified. And then she just snaps back to kind of this frozen feeling. And then she can become warm. And then maybe in the side of her eye, she's more aware of this situation than her programmers believe. And I just thought that there's a lot going on in her robotic performance. She's up there with the best of who has played robots in the past. Michael Fassbender. He was a good robot performer. Who else played good robots? Yul Brynner, of course. But
yeah, are you talking about human looking robots,
humanoid robots who are fooling us? I guess that's the Alien series for you. But
Haley Joel Osment in AI.
Oh yeah, perfect,
excellent.
When's he gonna factor in? Get Haley Joel up in here. Nice. Not
yeah, why isn't Haley Joel Osment visiting Westworld?
I laughed very 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 hard
SNL
than I almost ever laughed at SNL.
Haley Joel Osment. Haley Joel Osment now.
It was brilliant.
It was a good sketch.
Yeah, very funny.
Did either of you guys watch Dollhouse?
Yes,
no,
I
never
all
did.
All of Dollhouse, including its god-awful second season.
Didn't it end with a crazy episode that launched into the future or something?
It did.
What was that show about and why are people obsessed with it?
But it was basically this, but they would send out your host, and it wouldn't be a robot. It'd be a human whose brain was wiped.
This meets Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, I mean, there we go.
It wanted to do that on, you know, have an overarching story, but also be able to plug in, you know, more serialized adventures, you know, on a week by week basis. It was a lot of fun. I mean, for what it was, it had that show been made now on like an AMC or something, it could have been huge.
Instead, yeah, AMC has humans.
I'm interested to see if they even like verge into that area where people start getting reprogrammed and like everything has to bleed together, so it like takes a season to get a full character you understand.
Well, see, I keep thinking about Carnival. Did you guys watch Carnival?
Nope.
Oh,
I have not, but that's Ron Moore, so I should.
You really should. And for that show, I mean, obviously it was more of a biblical thing, Dust Bowl, circus life, versus, you know, there's this Jesus figure and then there's this preacher who is probably Satan and, you know, big forces of the world. And I keep thinking about that relationship and the Ed Harris and Anthony Hopkins characters, especially. I mean, you see it in the premiere and you start seeing it over the future episodes. It's not like a good versus evil, but you don't know who's good and you don't know who's evil. Maybe that's brewing, maybe it's not. But I don't know who the hero is of this show, and I like that, too, that it's not, we're not on an easily identified path, and maybe that's what Game of Thrones, the allure of Game of Thrones is, that good people can do bad things and bad people can do good things, but that seems to be consistent with Westworld, and I'm excited to see, especially with robots, you never know what they're going to do. They're robots. It's crazy.
Robots. Yeah, I'm down for a science fiction Game of Thrones, for sure.
Well, here it is.
Will it into existence, guys. Watch.
And that does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back probably next week. We kind of covered the bases this week with a mini Girl on the Train review. I'm not... David, anything else coming out? You have The Greasy Strangler, which we mentioned in the lightning round question, which I would highly recommend.
I have not seen.
What? You haven't seen it?
There's a movie called The Birth of a Nation opening on Friday you may have heard about. Oh. to say anything beyond that...
You can be honest here. You can be honest.
I've been honest about this movie since the moment I saw it, which is that my take on it is but one of many. But I was severely unimpressed with the filmmaking out of Sunday in January. It felt like I was getting crazy pills when the lights came up and people were still applauding. I thought it was amateurish to the extreme despite its evident passion and timeliness, and that the message of the movie far outclipsed the means by which it were. Was delayed, and Nate Parker has not done himself any favors in the time since or in the years before. So,
yeah, completely divorced from that. The Birth of a Nation is a troubling film because it wants to tell a great story and it does so in the most hackneyed Hollywood way. It's unfortunate, but
there was a piece today that was like the platonic ideal of why I did not write about The Birth of a Nation, because someone, let's just say more qualified, was going to do the same, and it was in, I believe, The New Yorker, and the argument was essentially, divorcing the filmmaking from the message as best it can. It is not a movie that is worth the time. It was very eloquently laid out why this is not good filmmaking, and should not have been received as such, and it's unfortunate that the filmmaker let down the... story that he's trying to tell and so on, but it's not a movie I recommend.
Cut yourself off. At least there's an Iranian horror film coming out this week that is very good,
which I also didn't really like.
Oh really? That's unfortunate. Under the Shadow. I found that quite chilling and poignant for, you know, that situation, that historical situation, or I don't know. Under the Shadow, that's where... Well, luckily there's a Terrence Malick film coming out that David...
And, actually, we can't talk about Birth of a Nation without mentioning that Ava DuVernay's documentary, which unfortunately I missed at when it premiered at the New York Film Festival on Friday, 13th...
Comes out on Netflix,
The 13th
right?
Amendment and systemic institutionalized racism in our prison systems, and how the private prisons and prisons in general became the new slavery. That hits Netflix on Friday for everyone to see. And while I have not seen it myself, I will take it on the faith of my colleagues that it is a strong alternative to Birth of a Nation.
There you go. There are options.
Oh, and then also, guys, Tuesday, October 11th, the limited Shin Godzilla starts. So, like, we'll have an episode that day, but if you need to buy tickets in advance or find a theater close to you that is playing it, fucking Shin Godzilla.
In theory, Dave, you will have seen it by then. Theory.
I mean, I will have seen it for sure by next Saturday, because the second they announce this limited engagement, me and my friends, we got our tickets, because I'm going to see this in the theater one way or the other, and I encourage you to do it. It's only the third Godzilla movie in my lifetime that's been available in theaters.
Yeah. Many options, and we'll be checking back on some of them in the future episodes, but until then, why don't we tell people where to find us, starting with me! I'm Matt Patches, the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter, at Mr. Patches. And remember, we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can find and listen to all the episodes. You can comment or leave suggestions. Anything is possible on fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me blogging at geek.com. You could find all of our podcasts at fightinginthewarroom.com. Storm of Spoilers is going to migrate off the fightinginthewarroom.com feed, guys. So if you want to get Storm of Spoilers, including Luke Cage, you got to go subscribe to it a la carte, either at fightinginthewarroom.com/godspoilers or on iTunes, Stitcher, you know, your podcast places. But for this week, since we don't have a review segment, we're going to be retweeting our lightning round answers, which has actually been a fun practice because then I get to see more of them than I usually do as the person who isn't on the review segment. This week, guys, in honor of The Greasy Strangler and Birth of a Nation, what's the most offensive movie that you love anyway? Tweet your responses to FITWR. That's the show. You can also follow that for fun little links to stuff that we write. Until next Tuesday, when you'll be getting your Shin Godzilla tickets, we'll talk to you later. Snow White.